This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So good evening, everyone. I'm Maurice Garcia, a urologist here at UCSF. Tonight I'll be speaking about female-to-male genital gender-affirming surgery. I will introduce myself. I am associate clinical professor in residence here at UCSF in the Department of Urology. I specialize in reconstructive sexual medicine and neurourology, and in a reconstructive genital surgery. I have training in transgender surgery, both male to female and female to male. I founded and have led our genital gender-affirming surgery program here at UCSF. We began in 2014, early 2014, and I teach residents and other faculty and so forth. My areas of interest are genital gender-affirming surgery, as well as surgical device design, outcomes research, and education. I'm here at UCSF in part because my own personal mission is, and point of sort of enjoyment and pride is in teaching, and I want to advance this field with evidence-based medicine and by contributing to the training of good qualified surgeons and physicians, which we have here at UCSF. I will soon be moving to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles to direct the transgender surgery to found and direct the transgender surgery program there. And we'll be leading a team there very soon, but we'll remain on faculty here at UCSF and involved in educational efforts here at UCSF. Let me move on. Disclosures, I have a few disclosures. These are to companies that I consult for or have intellectual property with. None of these are in conflict with the material present a conflict of interest with the material I'll present this evening. Let's go over an overview for tonight's talk. I'm going to talk a bit about transgender terminology and epidemiology. I know my colleagues in this lecture series have talked about this as well, but I think attendance is different per lecture, so I'll give a quick review. I'm going to focus more on the items below. Care guidelines and criteria for surgery, and then surgery overview, focusing tonight only on female-to-male surgery. Genital gender-affirming surgery in the United States today, what's the status of things. Insurance coverage, a brief sort of status overview of that here in California and elsewhere. And then I think the role of urologists. And I'll also comment on, I think, a very important topic, which is research and education. Again, part of our mission here at UCSF. So briefly, I introduced myself. How did I get here? I became involved in the care of transgender patients as early as even before 2007, offering orchiectomies to transgender women. And I, through that, learned about the sort of limited information there was out there for physicians and by physicians for the care of transgender patients, specifically surgical care. We've come a long way since 2007, not only in surgery, but also in sort of medical care in the community. I think flourished maybe a bit extreme, but it certainly increased significantly in our community and in major communities around the country. Certainly transgender care and transgender people, fortunately, have gotten a lot more visibility and their, you know, attention to the disparities in health care and access to care have been more recognized and I think are helping move forward legislation and policies and resources to help part of our population and members, co-members of our society. I did a fellowship in andrology and neurourology here at UCSF, as I mentioned. In early 2013, I made a case, petitioned my chair and our department for why we should invest in my training and dedicating resources, particularly my own, to bringing transgender surgery here to UC, genital surgery here to UCSF. Bless you. And to my chair's credit, Peter Carroll, he was very supportive and extremely supportive the entire way, and saw to it that I was able to go abroad to the United Kingdom to train with the UK's transgender surgery program leaders. And I returned in 2014, started our program here. I've led it and worked in a multidisciplinary fashion with colleagues here at UCSF. It's a multidisciplinary program. So it's equals coming together in a circle to provide comprehensive care. That's our model, and that's worked out quite well. And I work with, you know, GU reconstructive surgeons in my department, in plastic surgery, obstetrics and gynecology, colorectal surgery, medicine, family practice, endocrinology, dermatology, and so forth. So that's a good overview of how I got here and also what we offer. Let's go over some terminology. Gender is probably the most relevant term, or the most common term you'll read about and hear about in the context of, you know, transgender surgery and care. Gender refers to a complex internal sense, and the operative part here is the fact that it's an internal, person-based construct about being male, female, or other. You know, the world isn't, this doesn't have to be binary the way it's often described as male or female, as we see in nature and other, just historically. But, you know, maleness and femaleness are really two ends of a continuum. Gender identity is not the same thing as sexual identity or sexual orientation. Gender identity is how one perceives one's own gender. Again, it's a personal, internal construct. It was said very nicely by a colleague of mine, Jen Hastings, that's, you know, sexual identity is who you go to bed with, whereas gender identity is who do you go to bed as. So that, hopefully that's helpful in kind of delineating a difference between these two terms, gender identity and sexual identity. Transgender is another important key term. It's a term for people whose identity and expression, behavior, and general sense of self do not conform to what is associated with their birth sex, that is male or female, in the place they were born. And I think the last few words, in the place they were born, are very important because they highlight the fact that the gender is a social construct as well. Being male or man or woman in one society may be very different in another part of the world. So it's really tied into time and place, society and sort of history. So gender identity disorder is a historical term that refers to people who have what I'm about to describe as gender dysphoria. Gender identity disorder, transgender people were often or historically diagnosed as having a gender identity disorder. Today, I think we appreciate that that's a very pathologizing term. Sort of the worst part of it is the word disorder. In 2012, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5, which is basically the sort of catalog of mental health diagnoses that medicine acknowledges in mental health, changed this diagnostic term from gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria. I think acknowledging this. And it's nice to point out, I think it's worth pointing out, that in 1973, the same organization, the DSM, declassified homosexuality as what it was previously described as a mental disorder. So I think there's a history of recognizing that things that are different don't have to be, aren't necessarily disorders, but part of human variety. Gender dysphoria is the term we use today, and it's a term for the discomfort or distress caused to a person by a discrepancy between that person's internal gender identity and the sex that they were assigned at birth. So someone born with genitalia that defines them as male or female, but the person doesn't feel male or female necessarily. Gender nonconforming is another important term, and I think it's important to include this when talking about in some context, talking about transgender people and rights and acknowledgement of other people in our society. Gender nonconforming refers to the degree to which a person's gender identity, role, or expression differs from the cultural norms prescribed for the male or female sex. So there are some people who don't necessarily view themselves as of the opposite gender, transgender, but as something in between. So neither male or female. And there are various terms. I have another slide in a minute that sort of acknowledges that. This is a current term. So someone who's gender nonconforming or gender non-binary is someone who identifies as neither male or female, regardless of their birth sex or the sex they were assigned at birth. So being transgender or gender nonconforming is really ultimately a matter of diversity and not pathology. I think that's one of the important points to make here. Gender-affirming surgery is surgery to make a person's body in line with with the gender that they identify with. There's lots of terms for this. Historically, people have used sex reassignment surgery. I find that term a little bit, first of all, it's not patient-centered, and secondly, there's something a little bit patronizing. It conveys that someone else is assigning the patient something, whereas gender it's all about the patient. So I don't use that, and I think, in many places people are moving away from that term. There's gender-confirming surgery, gender-affirming surgery. I find gender-affirming surgery the most sort of patient-centered, person-centered term to use, and therefore I use it, but they all kind of refer to this surgery to accomplish this, to make a person's body in line and congruent with the gender that they identify with. This is a cartoon I quite like. I think it sort of drives home the point that I've been trying to make in the last slides, that is that gender identity is a fundamental sort of internal expression of who we are, who the person is inside. So it's not something that can be defined by genitalia necessarily. And then this slide, I think, is a very nice. I got this also from Dr. Jen Hastings, a colleague of mine who spoke in this series. It's a nice Venn diagram that I think, shows the continuum, the different sort of identities and terms that people can fall into. I mean, this is nature. People, we all exist somewhere on this continuum of male to female. And there's also people who identify as, agender, is neither, or gender fluid, sort of changing. So I think it's just worth looking at this and considering it. And I think the lesson here is that there's a spectrum, and everyone falls somewhere on that spectrum. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about epidemiology. One thing is for certain, and that is that the incidence and prevalence of, being of transgender people or transsexualism is grossly underestimated. There are several epidemiologic studies from the last several years, not as many as we would think, but there are some. And every year, every time that one comes out, it concludes a higher incidence than the one from the year or years previous to that. And I think that that reflects the fact that society is changing and becoming more accepting. I think transgender people are being just more accounted for and counted in census studies and such. Gender nonconformity, another observation from a review of the epidemiological studies that have been made, is that gender nonconformity among female to male people is sort of relatively, it's not invisible, but it's less visible in Western cultures, simply because it's sort of more accepted for people we assume are women to pass as men or to be perceived as men rather than the other way around. Another observation is that all countries that currently provide genital gender-affirming surgery consistently report a steady increase in the number of people presenting to their gender clinics for surgery or for care and or surgery. This is certainly true in the UK where I trained. Every year, the number of cases, the queue for surgery goes up. And again, I think that's just people being increasingly accounted for. The most recent epidemiologic census estimates, which made the cover of the New York Times about 6 months ago, were from a group in UCLA, or from UCLA, that found, you know, used U.S. Census data and then other studies of their own, and estimated the incidence, the prevalence rather, of transgender people in the United States to be 0.6% of the U.S. population. This translates to about 1.4 million people, with a sizable number in all 50 states. The state with the highest prevalence is surprisingly the state of Hawaii. California is number two only in this study. And both of those are second only to the District of Columbia, which is not a state, but has per capita the most transgender people in their studies. So it's quite interesting. But transgender people are all over the places that you'd, states that, you know, you might not associate with transgender people. They're everywhere. And 1.4 million people is a big number. Let's talk about treatment and need for care. Surgical care. So gender dysphoria can, studies have shown it can be alleviated with treatment. But treatment and treatment takes various forms. There's therapy or mental health therapy, work with a mental health care provider, psychiatrist, psychologist, a counselor. There's hormone therapy or the use of hormones that are in line with the person's identified with gender. And there's also gender-affirming surgery. The focus of treatment for treatment of gender dysphoria is on helping the patient explore their own gender identity. That's where it really starts. It's not to change anything. It's not to. It's just simply to help them explore it and come to terms with it, and then live it. By doing that in a way that there's not opposition to it, gender dysphoria can be diminished and in many cases eliminated for people. It's to find a gender role that is comfortable for them, for that individual person. Not everybody needs all three types of treatment, mental health therapy or counseling, hormones or surgery. Treatment is really individualized. As a surgeon, I see patients who want surgery, but there are many people who do flourish and live very happily with hormone therapy and with social transition. That is simply living as that gender, dressing, presenting themselves, in many cases assuming a name in line with the gender they identify with, and just sort of being who they are. For other people, the same, but they want surgery. So it's all different. And so, again, many patients or people may or may not require body modification. I think another important point to make here is that surgery does not necessarily equal genital surgery. For some people, facial feminizations, for some transgender women, facial feminization surgery is the most important for them to address their gender dysphoria. For other people, it's genital surgery. For other people, it's chest surgery. It's different. So we can't assume or expect, you know, that everything's the same. Let's talk about professional care guidelines. So the single most the single professional organization in the United States and internationally for the care of transgender people, the leading organization by far is WPATH, or the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. And it was established in 1979, you know, under, people may remember the terms, Harry Benjamin. It's an international multidisciplinary professional association whose mission it is to promote evidence-based care, education, research advocacy, public policy, and respect in transgender health. And I think the most important, these are all important terms, but the most important thing is evidence-based research. WPATH does not claim, they publish guidelines, they don't publish laws or you know, sort of dictums that have to be followed. It's an international organization, and if you recall at the beginning of the lecture, we talked about how gender is a social construct that has, it's sort of defined to a great measure by by the society in which the person lives. So care for transgender people is different, and the issues that they face are very different throughout the world. Therefore, it's not reasonable to assume that there's one governing body of their care, but rather a society, an organization like WPATH that promotes evidence-based research and guidelines based on evidence that are recommended for adoption, and also WPATH accepts changes and tweaking on the local level for that society where care is being offered. As I said, WPATH publishes what are called the WPATH Standards of Care Guidelines, or SOC guidelines. The current one is version 7 from, I believe, 2012. There's a new one that's going to be published soon. And I strongly encourage you to just Google WPATH SOC or Standards of Care. You'll find it. It's a big PDF. And look through it. It's a very thoughtful document that's got a lot of information about transgender people, epidemiology, the care issues that they face, and guidelines, and most importantly, the basis for the guidelines, so that caregivers can sort of think them through and adjust them as needed. There's inherent flexibility in the guidelines. As I said, WPATH is the most established and the only international professional association for transgender healthcare. There's a meeting. The WPATH meets, the International Association meets every 2 years, and this year in Los Angeles, February 2nd to February 5th is the inaugural scientific session of USPATH, which is a U.S. Meeting of WPATH. About 80% of the WPATH membership is from the United States, so we're going to start having meetings here in the United States, and I would encourage you to attend or look into it. It'll be on the UCLA campus February 2nd to February 5th. I want to point out that the WPATH Standards of Care Guidelines and criteria are recognized by all major U.S. healthcare professional associations, the AMA, the American Psychiatric Association, the Department of Health and Human Services, the U.S. Department of State with respect to passports and so forth, and the changing of gender on official government documents. All of these organizations recognize the WPATH guidelines, as well as all major U.S. health insurance companies. So this professional organization, of which I'm a member and a strong believer in, it's relevant in various levels in our society now. And so I encourage anyone interested in this field to participate, become acquainted with the organization and the guidelines, and participate. Let's talk about criteria for genital gender-affirming surgery. People often ask, does one just go ahead and get surgery, or what's the process? So the Standards of Care guidelines recommend that people wishing to undergo genital gender-affirming surgery, undergone at least a year of mental health care or therapy. There's flexibility in that. Not everyone has had a personal need to undergo an entire year's worth of therapy. Certainly an evaluation, as we'll talk about in a moment with the referral letters, certainly some connection with a mental health professional to at least review their transition. And I'd see if any areas for help can be identified, any needs, unmet needs. But So connection with a mental health provider is certainly a guideline criteria. Another is that the patient, have taken at least have been on the gender congruent hormones for at least a year, and that they have transitioned socially. That is full-time life living in the gender that they identify with, also for at least a year. So in a way, it makes perfect sense before committing to something as sort of irreversible as surgery that the person have already sort of advanced in their transition. These are, I think, guidelines certainly that I here at UCSF and elsewhere at Cedars adhere to. Another is two referral letters from a qualified mental health professional. That doesn't mean psychiatrist necessarily, psychologist, MFTs, but mental health providers, not primary care physicians and so forth. So two referral letters speaking to the person's readiness for the surgery, and also their coping, their ability to adapt to the challenges that they may face in pursuing surgery, that they have support and resources, internal and family support or friends, and so forth, to see them through the process. It may be that in the future, excuse me, two referral letters may not be required. It's onerous to many of my patients. That guideline may change to one, but at least one letter, and often with a second letter speaking, attesting to the first, is still a WPATH guideline requirement for surgery. As we discussed today, we're going to talk about female-to-male genital gender-affirming surgeries. We've talked about male-to-female in the last lecture. So with that, let's move forward. Phalloplasty refers to the construction of a penis. There are different types of phalloplasty. We'll also talk about other surgeries involved in female-to-male surgery, and that is the removal of the sort of female genitalia and reproductive organs. But first, let's sort of focus on the phalloplasty itself. There's patients want different things from this. Some people want sort of a minimalist, approach, just they want their genitalia to be different, not female, and they're okay with a smaller penis made from their clitoris, for example, which we'll talk about in a second. Other patients want, a full size penis with or without an integrated urethra. So at this point, you're probably wondering, well, what dictates what people want? All of these choices are for patients are really balanced by what they want and the risks associated with pursuing these surgeries. Some surgeries are more complex than others and have a higher rate of complication associated with the surgery. So patients are sort of have to weigh these things. And this is an attempt by me to sort of give you a sense of sort of the general sort of, what the landscape looks like. So the second is full-size penis, a phallus with or without a neo-urethra, a urethra made for them. One option is to have a full-size penis made without a urethra and then to have a neo-urethra made later for them if they, here I say required, if they choose to. The outcome of the phalloplasty really depends on the donor site, where we're getting the tissues to make the penis, the phallus. So let's go over the different types of phalloplasty. The first is, it's called metoidioplasty, which is refers to use of the native clitoris. Remember from anatomy that a clitoris is really It's the female homologue of the male penis. So it's got a glands for sensation and a shaft. It's just smaller, and it doesn't have a urethra with it. So trans men who have been on testosterone for a long time, this part of their anatomy, their native anatomy, grows into a bigger size than a natal woman, so it's like a small penis. It's bigger, and with metoidioplasty, we help make it appear more like a penis. We free it up and do reconstructive surgery to give it a greater appearance, and also with that use labial tissues to create a scrotum. So it's a type of phalloplasty, but it's using basically only native structures. Other options include radial forearm free flap phalloplasty. We call those that a wrap. It's use of the non-dominant, typically non-dominant forearm skin, the skin and the fat, to make a penis and a urethra, or just a penis, depending on their preference. Another option is to use to perform what's called anterolateral thigh free flap phalloplasty, which is a long way of saying use of the anterior or front area of the thigh, the upper leg, to preserve that, to mobilize a big section of that skin and make a penis with or without a urethra, and keep the blood vessels to it and put them where a penis belongs to make a phallus. Other options, which are less commonly practiced here in the States, include a latissimus dorsi free flap, which is basically use of muscle and skin from the side, the flank area. And another is suprapubic phalloplasty, or a pedicle flap, use of just tummy skin, skin below the belly button, to make a penis. This somewhat complicated-looking slide it's important to give a good overview of the different surgeries and in what order they're performed. So that's called in surgery we call that staging. If you have multiple surgeries to perform, you perform them in, they can be performed in different stages. So the first stage is the first surgery. In my practice and in the UK where I trained, we just do phalloplasty in the first stage. I'll point out that other surgeons in the United States and in Europe do stages 1 and 2, which I show here. They do those in one stage as opposed to two stages. But I'm going to explain it the way I perform this. Phalloplasty is done in the first stage, the making of the penis with or without the urethra. And again, I list the different surgical approaches. I also list, the surgeons that I, as a urologist, would operate with for some phalloplasties with a plastic surgeon, but for some, not for others, and only for the first stage. In other centers in Europe, in the UK, rather, my urology colleagues do all of these and don't do it with plastic surgeon. It's all variable. As long as it just depends on whoever's doing it, if they're competent to do it, that's fine. But anyway, stage one is the phalloplasty. And then 4 to 6 months later, we do stage two, which includes the following items. So this can be done with or without a laparoscopic hysterectomy, usually at the beginning of the surgery, one of our gynecology colleagues will come in and remove the uterus and one or both ovaries. And then in stage two, we perform the urethral join-up. So we join the person's native urethral opening to the urethra from the phallus and urethra that we just made. The urethra, when we put the penis where it belongs, we just open the urethra up to the skin next to the base of the penis. So the urethra doesn't really drain urine or see it. In fact, that's one of the benefits of it, is that it's kept away from urine for a while to allow it to heal. So at the second stage, we join up the urinary tract so that urine goes from the bladder and exits the body from the tip of the phallus. At that time, we also perform vaginectomy. So removing the vaginal cavity inside, we close it up. We remove part of the skin and then close it up. There's glansplasty, which is creating a head, the appearance of what looks like a normal head of a penis, the glands. At that time, we also usually perform place one testicle prosthesis. We place only one for patients who plan to later undergo placement of a penile prosthesis, and that's stage three. The pump for a penile prosthesis serves as a testicular prosthesis. So in stage two, we'll just place one testicular prosthesis. And then very importantly in stage two, we transpose the clitoris, that is, move the clitoris from where it was located at birth to the just below the skin near the base of the penis. So not under the penis, which some surgeons do, but rather just beneath the skin so that it is stimulated with intercourse or manually. And it's also, very importantly, hidden from view. The clitoris is a very female structure, and I think patients sort of uniformly feel that it, you know, its presence or its visibility aggravates their gender dysphoria. They don't want to see it. So we make it disappear while preserving the important function of the clitoris, which is erogenous sensation. So that's moved to the base of the to near the base of the penis, and then 4 to 6 months later, we can perform stage 3, which for those patients who want to undergo placement of an erectile device, an inflatable or malleable cylinders inside the penis, so that for erection and penetrative intercourse, that's done in stage 3, and placement of a penile prosthesis can be performed for all except metoidioplasty. So if just the clitoris is used as a penis, there isn't a device available to make the clitoris become hard. But any other penis that we make from skin anywhere from the body can have a penile prosthesis put into it to allow the person to have intercourse. So let's talk a little bit about metoidioplasty. Again, if you recall, that is the use of the native clitoris to create a small penis. We don't like to use the term female terms for anatomy. I don't like to with my transgender men, that they're men, just as we wouldn't use the opposite gender, you know, the opposite gender when we go to the doctor for anything. We use sort of gender congruent terms. So, we typically refer to the penis as the micropenis, what they were born with as a clitoris. So we release it and then lengthen it with this surgery. The native clitoris is sort of a little bit hook-shaped. The top part is longer than the bottom part, the underside of it. So with this surgery, we release the skin that tethers it and keeps it always like this, and we allow it to become a straighter structure. So it hangs and has more of an appearance of a pendulous penis. This can be done with or without creation of a urethra, what we call a neo-urethra. Neo refers to the... It means new. So we can make a micro penis with or without a neo-urethra. If we do it with a urethra, it's done in two stages. In the first stage, there's different ways of doing this, but the way I do it is I take mouth lining skin, buccal mucosa, and lay it on the undersurface of the clitoris and let that heal. And then later, at the second stage, I free the clitoris with the micropenis up, the clitoris, and to make a micropenis, and also roll the skin on the underside to make a urethra, that new mouth skin. The man does not want a neo-urethra, this metoidioplasty can be done in one stage. Sometimes it's done in three stages. I think, historically you may see that or read about that, but typically it's one to two stages, as I've just described. This surgery is associated with minimal, relatively fewer complications than the others. If a neo-urethra is made, that's where complications arise. There can be strictures, scarring that prevent the passage of urine. There's fistulas. Just the penis. The penis surgery itself has minimal to very minimal complications. Metoidioplasty allows the man to stand to pee, something that's very important for a lot of men. Consider how often we go to the bathroom a day. It's going to the men's room is part of being a man, and being able to urinate or do a bodily function like everyone else is important for many people. So this allows the man to stand to pee, and it also preserves their erogenous or sexual sensation in their genitalia. This patient here in this picture has had testicular prostheses made. The vaginal cavity, the uterus has been removed, and the vaginal cavity has been removed and closed. That cleft that you see in the middle is just a little groove in the sac, but everything is closed down here. And two testicular prostheses are present. And with metoidioplasty, we can leave the micropenis with a sort of uncircumcised look, a little bit like this one, or a circumcised look with less of that sort of redundant foreskin. A clitoris has a foreskin just as a penis does, so we can do that. And here you see the scars on the side. This is where the labia majora, which from birth extended up here, the ends of the labia majora are brought down to here, and that's where a lot of this extra skin comes from. These are brought down, and the bottom of the labia, which you can't see in this picture, are brought up. So the labia are sort of scrunched in a way, so to give it more of a sac-like, to create more of a sac-like structure. Let's talk about phalloplasty without a urethra. So if we make a penis from whatever skin we end up doing, the staging is as follows in my practice and in the UK. Three stages. The first stage is the phalloplasty, the second the glands and the testicle prosthesis and the vaginectomy, which I talked about, and then the erectile device. However, if we make a penis without a urethra, it's possible to go back later and make a urethra, add a urethra to it. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. That's called radial artery urethroplasty, or RAU, R-A-U. That's got to come from somewhere. And it has to, very importantly, that skin has to have its own blood supply. There are some people who perform surgeries to make urethras out of mouth skin or skin from other parts of the body, but where the skin is totally detached. The literature does not support very good outcomes with that, in my opinion. I think the best outcomes, as with any flap surgery, is when we use a flap skin that has its own dedicated blood supply. And that's what we can do in a surgery I'll show you in a second. So for someone who has a phalloplasty initially without a urethra, we can put one in, and then again, there's that same second, or in this case, third stage on the right, where we do the join-up, where we bring the urethra in the second surgery, and then later join up the native urethra to the new urethra, do the other surgeries, the glansplasty, the vaginectomy, and so forth. And then always, 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 the last surgery we ever perform is placement of the erectile device. Why? Because the erectile device is a prosthetic, and if it gets infected, it's going to have to come out, guaranteed. So we want to avoid that at all costs. So we only put it in when all is said and done. It's clear that the patient's not having infections. They're draining their urine okay. Everything is calm. Then we put the erectile device in last. So let's talk about some of the phalloplasties or other phalloplasties now. We've talked about metoidioplasty. Let's talk about suprapubic phalloplasty. This is, in fact, the simplest one to perform. Again, there's pros and cons to everything. The pro is that it's simple. It doesn't require use of the arm and scarring that's left on the arm, but it has limitations. It doesn't have any real sensation. So a nice penis can be made from tummy skin, which I'll show you in a second, but all but maybe a half inch or an inch of the base of the penis, the phallus, has no sensation. There's just a little bit of sensation near the base. We take a pedicle flap of skin from the tummy area and then tubularize it and then bring it down, just sort of flop it down. This surgery, because it's using tummy skin, which is not ideal for, it's not ideal for making a urethra, and secondly, the blood supply to the skin is not especially robust. We do not make a urethra from tummy skin. A good thing is that the donor site is just the tummy, so the scars can be well hidden and are fairly minimal. Another benefit with his surgery is that the clitoris can be transposed to the base of the phallus. So we can make the clitoris disappear and bring erogenous sexual, that is sexual sensation, to the phallus by moving the clitoris to it. So let me show you. And patients that have this type of phalloplasty, we leave their urethral opening where either where it is, so in their sort of lower area, or we can move it back a little bit to the perineum, so that, but that means they have to sit to pee, or we can lengthen the urethra a little bit to where the clitoris is, so they can stand to pee by pointing their their previously clitoris, now micropenis, to direct their urinary stream to a urinal from a standing position. If they choose that option, we can't move the clitoris to the penis. So you start to see all the, you know, anything that's done requires something else. So I spend a lot of time talking to patients about all the options and every permutation. If you choose this option, it means this. And you have to know that ahead of time. So we discuss all that. Here's the tummy area that a suprapubic phalloplasty uses to make the penis. We make sort of a double paddle shape incision. This is just an ink marking pen, and roll that flap down and tubularize it. So the penis will have a suture line or a stitch line along the dorsal part, the top part of the penis that you can see. And then obviously there's a big gap where we take that skin from, so we bring the anterior abdominal skin down. So the belly button, literally, we just literally bring it all down, pull it down like a shirt almost, and sew it together so that the defect is covered. By defect, we mean the gap. That's what we call in surgery a gap, the defect, the space that needs to be filled. And you see that here. So the tummy skin is brought down, and the patient ends up with this sort of linear incision, as you see here. And there you see the penis and the stitch line on the top part. It doesn't have a glans or anything. Remember, second stage is when we do the glansplasty. This is what it looks like initially. And believe it or not, it ends up looking quite nice. It'll end up looking like this. So let's switch gears and talk about what is really the gold standard in phalloplasty today, and that's radial artery forearm flap. So this offers what it refers to as use of skin from the forearm, so below the elbow, up to the wrist, but not including the hand, and it's the majority of the forearm skin. This offers a full-size penis and urethra if the patient desires it. It can be made with or without a urethra. The sensation is generally very good. We keep the nerves from the arm skin. We cut the nerves and then sew them to one of the two clitoral nerves. So if you think about it, a clitoris, just like a penis, has two nerves that send sensation, sexual sensation to the brain. We've shown that if we cut one of those nerves and patch the nerves from the skin that we're bringing to it, to that nerve, to the butt end of the cut clitoral nerve, the brain, any sensation to the skin previously from here, now on the where the penis is, stimulation of that skin makes the brain light up, and the brain thinks that the clitoris is being stimulated, or that area of the body. So that's called, it's called nerve anastomosis. We connect the nerves up, and that can give excellent sensation. And I've published on that in our patients in the UK that with penetration alone, a forearm phalloplasty, phallus or penis, can provide orgasm, which is pretty remarkable. And as far as appearance goes, radial artery forearm flap phalloplasty gives, I think, unequivocally the best cosmesis, the best appearance. So here I have some pictures. These are the markings that we mark on the forearm. On the left here, again, I said this is the antecubital fossa of the elbow, and then here's the wrist. So we use the majority of the forearm skin. We take it all as one big piece of skin, but we separate one rectangular piece to be the urethra. It's a little longer. This kind of scratched out area here is we cut that skin away, and then we keep this long bit of skin that wraps around the arm, and we end up turning this narrow rectangle into a tube and then wrapping the bigger piece around that tube with the skin on the outside. So you end up with something that we call a tube within a tube. The inner tube has skin on the inside. That's what urine sees as it passes by. And the outer part of the flap has skin on the outside. That's the penis skin, the skin you see on a penis here. Okay? So here's the patient's arm. We've elevated the flap and put a big gauze pad on the arm that has no skin now and just have the flap sitting there. It's still connected to its blood vessels. And then when we're ready, we cut the blood vessels to the skin and cut the nerves and fashion a tube out of it. We tubularize everything. We put a catheter in the center. And then here's the penis before it's been moved to where it's going to be, where it belongs in the man, at the... In the pubic area, with the radial forearm flap phalloplasty, the stitch line is on the underside of the penis, and it heals up beautifully. And you can make a full-sized penis with it. This little thing sticking out is a little drain that will take that out at some point. And do you remember how I said how in the UK we do phalloplasty in two stages? So in the first stage, we just make the penis and the urethra and connect the urethra up to the skin next to where the clitoris or the micropenis lives, and it just stays there for 4 to 6 months. So there's no urine going out through this urethra, and that's one of the benefits of this staged approach. We think stricture rate is lower, fistula rate is lower, and if there is a stricture, there's still healthy non-hair-bearing skin down below between the labia. The labia minora on a natal woman have no hair, so we can still use that skin for reconstruction purposes to treat strictures. Whereas if all of this is done in a one-stage surgery, we believe, and I have found in all the patients I've treated that have had this elsewhere, that by the time I get them with a stricture down here, if it's been done in one stage, the labia, which have hair, the labia majora have hair, everything's been brought to midline, and there's no non-hair-bearing skin in the neighborhood to mobilize and use to treat the stricture. So that's a limitation. And I think also just passing urine through skin before it's healed, I think also promotes stricture. But there is no, to be fair, there's no level one evidence to prove that one is better than the other. I'm just sharing with you the rationale for doing this in two stages and why I do it. And in our experience, we've done it in both ways, in one and two stages. Our outcomes are better in two stages rather than one. But I think a randomized trial will shed further light on this. And as I said, we move the penis right to where it belongs. Basically, the bottom of this circle where we're going to put the penis is at the top of the clitoral fold. In a person born with a clitoris. So these are all ink markings. We make a cut through here and core out this circle, and that's where we patch the penis, the phallus, onto. So if we're taking all the skin from the arm, what's going to happen to the arm when it doesn't have all that skin and fat? It's just literally muscle and bone. So there's different ways to cover that up. Here is I haven't shown you a picture of the arm with the muscles, but one way of doing it is to take a skin graft from the thighs. The downside is, A, that skin is very thin and does not give the best cosmetic appearance, and two, it leaves these sort of yucky scars on the patient's thighs. In England, what we do and what I do here is we take these big areas of tissue from the buttocks, from either the lower fold or the upper fold of the buttock. Most people can spare a little bit of buttock fat and skin. It's not very visible anyway. And this is, it's thicker, very good skin to cover the arm with. So we cut this skin out on both sides and then patch it onto the arm and cover the arm. And when it heals, You can see a scar. I think this is a fairly average scar. Some look better and some don't look better. Some look worse and have kind of a step off. That's a limitation to radial artery forearm flap phalloplasty is the arm. But again, the penis itself, I think, looks quite good, and after glanceplasty has a very natural appearance. So forearm flap, free flap phalloplasty is reliable. The patient can stand a void. It's sensate. It provides sensation. It does require multiple stages. It does have a high revision rate. The revisions are usually small, addressing a stricture or this or that. A little bit of skin doesn't survive and it has to be nipped off. And, you know, there's things like that. But overall, there's a very, I think, the highest level of satisfaction. One thing I didn't mention is where the blood vessels to the penis go to. So the big blood vessels from the arm are connected to groin vessels here on the side. That's what this incision is for. And then the artery can either be from the artery from the arm skin can either be connected to a branch of the femoral artery, or it can be connected to the inferior epigastric artery, which comes along down here and goes up the belly. So we bring that artery, flip it down, and connect everything down here. So arteries and veins are connected to the skin, so the skin can heal, can survive and heal nicely. Let's talk about radial artery urethroplasty. So remember I said we can also make a penis with no urethra and then go back later and make a urethra for it. So now that I've introduced how we bring skin from here and make it live to be a penis and a urethra, we can do the same thing but just not make the penis out of it. Only we can take a smaller piece of skin from the arm, keep the arteries and veins and nerves from it, and just make a urethra. And that's what radial artery urethroplasty is. It's got a smaller donor site defect. Donor site refers to the part of the body where we get the skin. So we're taking less skin. There's a smaller scar area. And most have at least one nerve for sensation, to give some erogenous sensation and touch sensation to the urethra. Here we have may need hair removal. Depending on where we get it, the inner part of the forearm is typically hairless, but most patients need to have permanent hair removal of that skin before we can use it for the urethra. So here's the part of the body that we have them undergo hair removal. Remember, men on testosterone, trans men on testosterone, are often very hairy. Testosterone makes people very hairy. It's very virilizing. So they need to undergo laser or electrolysis. I've published on the fact that laser hair removal is more efficient and more permanent than electrolysis. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's in the end faster. And it takes about 9 months for enough cycles to be given so that there's no hair regrowth. It's very important. If there's hair inside the urethra, you can imagine that leads to problems. Urine gets more trapped in the urethra. They can get stones on the hair in the urethra. The hair can block the emptying of urine through the urethra. So it has major, major problems. They can also get fistulas from it as well, from infection. So it's very important to remove the hair permanently from the skin that we're going to use for the urethra. So this is what the donor site looks like in a radial artery urethroplasty. It's much smaller. We bring the urethra into the penis that was already made and connect it up to the blood vessels in the groin that I explained a moment ago. And there you have it. When it heals, there's a nice opening and patients can pass their urine from there. Again, the urethra, when we make it and put it in, we don't let it have contact with urine for a few months to let it heal. And here are what we call in the UK the bum flaps, the bottom, the skin flaps from the butt or the bottom. And this is sort of, it's like a buttock tuck, which I guess some people have plastic surgeons do for them to take butt off of them. But in this case, we're doing it to harvest skin for a good purpose so they don't have to have a big scar on their thighs. And then here's a nice arm. You can see the scar, but it's not, super visible. And what a lot of people do is they get intricate, kind of lacy tattoos that are intricate, lattice-like, or anything small. It really obscures the scar lines and such. And now, you know, forearm tattoos are very common in our society, so it's a nice thing for people to do. I'm going to quickly go through anterior lateral thigh phalloplasty. This is another option. Some men choose to have this instead of the arm. That choice is usually driven by the fact that they don't want to have a big scar on their arm. But some people, maybe they've had surgery and their arm skin is just not usable. So we have this other alternative. And it's basically, let me just quickly show you a picture. This is the anterior, remember I said anterior means front, the front side of the thigh. And it's a big flap area that we make. Actually, just show you here. We take kind of the same template, a long, narrower segment for the urethra, and then a long or a wide segment for the phallus. And this gets tubularized, so it's skin inside, and this gets tubularized, so there's skin outside. The same as with the arm, and we make the penis that way. Limitations with ALT phalloplasty is that there's typically less sensation in the thigh skin, so which means there's less sensation when we connect it up to the clitoral nerve. We need a thin thigh. A lot of people can be kind of chunky in their thighs. We store, as humans, we store fat different parts of the body. Typically, thigh skin has more fat underneath the skin. And that ends up with a very thick, in many cases, too thick and chunky penis. We have to defat it at the time of surgery. And doing that, we risk injuring the vessels that are going to keep that skin alive. So it's a little bit more touch and go. And just as with any other phalloplasty that we're going to make a urethra with, a part of the skin has to be hairless, the part that's going to be for the urethra. This is less common in Europe. And, you know, I'd say here it's less common than arm phalloplasty, radial artery forearm flap phalloplasty. And we typically try to use this only if the forearm is either unsuitable or if the patient just has a strong preference to not use their arm. Here are some other pictures. This is, depending on the patient's skin color, people with darker skin tend to heal with a little bit more scarring, with a greater potential for keloid, that kind of big, thick, exuberant scar that we can see. But people heal differently, but it does result in a visible scar area. And then this scar can be covered either with skin from the bottom or from a thinner skin strip from the thighs. We do it using the bottom, the patient's buttocks. I want to comment that I've had a number of patients, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the research we've been doing, but I've had a number of patients that have gotten, you see how this patient's ALT flap phalloplasty, phallus, is kind of football shape. It's quite thick in the center. I've gotten a number of patients who've had penises made that were simply too thick to even insert into their partners. They can't use it for sex because it's too wide. Penis length is not a big insurmountable problem. You just insert less of it during intercourse, but if it's too thick, you can't get it into a human orifice. So it's a challenge. And, you know, I do revise these. I make them thinner. It's an interesting sort of research area. But it's very important to counsel patients that they may need that down the road. In stage two, we do with either the radial artery forearm flap or the ALT flap phalloplasty. As I've already said, we do the join-up urethroplasty, do the glansplasty. I'm just reminding you. And then the vaginectomy, with or without hysterectomy, if they haven't already had it. And then we bury the clitoris under the skin near the base of the shaft. At the join-up phalloplasty, complications include stricture. When we do it in two stages, the stricture rate is significantly lower in our experience than if we do it in one stage. Fistulas can happen from infection or ischemia. That's basically the connection of urine, the drainage of urine from the urinary tract to the outside, the skin, to exit the body where it shouldn't be exiting. It's important to avoid hairy skin, as I've said. Patients can get hairballs, stone in the skin, obstruction, and infections. So at second stage, it's a bit mysterious to people. So in first stage, we've made a phallus here. This is a thigh flap, so it's a little bit chunkier. Here's the native clitoris, and all of this skin is really great because it has no hair on it. So that's why if there's a stricture here or something, we can bring some of the skin up and use it. That's a benefit. But we basically tubularize the area outlined here in ink, and that becomes the patient's, this part of the urethra. And then, of course, we cut off the skin, just the skin covering the clitoris, and then because you can't bury skin, and we move the head of the clitoris, we free it up the shaft and bring it up here. And that works out quite well. For urethral strictures, just as in regular or general urology, non-transgender surgery urology, a great source of skin to manage strictures is buccal mucosa. Buccal refers to the inside of the mouth, or buccal refers to the mouth. We can cut out a little bit of the skin. It grows back quite nicely, and that's hairless skin that has a good chance of growing wherever you patch it onto. Other things we do in stage two, as I've said many times now, the glansplasty. We create the head of a penis I made these drawings for a publication on the American Urologic Association, AUA updates on transgender surgery. We make these incision, the line closest to the base is an incision, and we basically free up the skin between the line, this line and the line closest to the tip, and then roll that skin under itself, as I show here, and then put stitches to keep it there, and then bring a little strip of skin, which looks like a shirt collar over here. We bring that skin. It's typically hairless skin. I typically take from the sort of side part of our body, which typically has no hair. I'll put that little patch of skin in there, and that will give this sort of nice color, like a different color, and will help give it sort of the appearance of a head. Another thing we do in stage three now, again, always the last stage, whether it's stage three or four, is once everything is settled and there's no infections, we're sure there's no infections, we do place the penile prosthesis. These devices, unfortunately, an area that this field lacks is surgical devices made for transgender men and transgender anatomy. So these are inflatable cylinders. This is a device for natal men, for non-transgender men. There's two because we put two in a natal penis. A little pump that goes into the scrotum, and then this reservoir which holds water that we put behind the abdominal wall somewhere. And when a man wants an erection, he squeezes this little ball in their scrotum, and these things get full of water, and you get a rigid erection. Well, we have to modify all this for transgender anatomy because there's not a natural penis with the natural cavities into which to put these cylinders. So we use this. We typically only use one cylinder for a neophallus because there's not enough room often to put two in, and we have to put this graft material in, and this graft material is what we sew and anchor it to bone so that the device doesn't just float around and move, again, since there isn't a natural compartment into which to put it. So let's take a break here and just kind of go over some questions that I thought you might be interested in. These are things that patients and people ask me a lot. Can a man who's had any of these surgeries have an orgasm? And the answer is a resounding yes. I published this in 2013 from our group and patients we operated on in the UK. Those that have had radial artery forearm flap phalloplasty have the best success with the ability to achieve an orgasm with penetration alone. So let's hold ourselves to a high standard here. If we're going to bring the clitoris, you know, we want a penis ideally that has its own sexual sensation, just as it does in a natal man. So with penetration of the penis alone, these men, over 60% can have an orgasm with penetration alone. The rest may require manual stimulation at the base of their penis, where we've buried the clitoris to achieve orgasm. Interestingly, I found that when men have placement of a penile prosthesis, they almost invariably report even better sensation or a better ability to have an orgasm. And I think my personal theory for this is that with a penile prosthesis inside the penis, it's the prosthesis serves as a backboard against which the clitoris can be stimulated. So if this is the penis and the clitoris is just underneath the skin, if I touch it like this, the clitoris will feel it, but the clitoris will kind of get squished back to the center of my finger. Whereas if there's a penile prosthesis in my finger, or the penis, when it touches the clitoris has nowhere to move to, and it just gets stimulated more sort of more forcefully. So it's actually, you know, counterintuitive. I would have thought maybe there would have been a loss of sensation, but we found the opposite, which is quite exciting. The other very important thing I published in that paper is that I showed that when trans men undergo transposition of their clitoris to the base of their penis, they do not lose sexual sensation. The number one reason I found why men didn't have transposition of their clitoris to the penis was a fear of loss of any sexual sensation. They only have one clitoris. So you can understand, you know, you don't want to lose that. But, I found not only did they not lose it, but many of them reported even better sexual sensation than before surgery, usually acknowledging that it's just sort of more satisfying to have an orgasm with the body that you're supposed to have. But at the very least, we can say that there's not a loss of sexual sensation when we move the clitoris to the base of the penis. That's super important. So I always tell patients that. That's the second bullet point here. And then the third is satisfaction. Very, very, very high. Even when complications do happen. In my hands and the best surgeons in the world, in their hands, we have a saying in surgery, if you don't have complications, you don't operate enough, because it's part of the landscape. But even when people have complications, they're very satisfied with the surgery. And I reported that as well, that people invariably say, I asked them, would you do it all over? And they say yes, because I feel more whole. You know, everyone has their own reason, but in general, people just feel more complete. Even with the problems and complications, they feel more whole. Some of the interesting revision surgery cases that I and I'm sure other surgeons that do this can see. I've mentioned this one. The penis is too thick. A stricture at the base of the penis in the urethra. So there's leakage of urine and infection out of the base. This patient had a surgeon used fibula, that's lower leg bone, to make the penis, lower leg skin and bone, to make a penis with a sort of a natural erectile device. I personally don't think I don't recommend that procedure because, the bone can erode through the skin. So I had to remove the bone from the penis. So let's talk a little bit about unique challenges that patients face. I think these are things that I sort of gleaned from my own experience caring for patients. I think it's, there's many, but one is acclimating to using sort of, things that other men take for granted and that we've all been sort of socialized to since we were little kids, using a bathroom. A lot of people may have, not everyone, but some men, at least initially, may have fear of using or anxiety associated with using urinals, people seeing them. All that just takes getting used to. I'm not saying that trans men, all of them, fear all this, but it's something that a lot of men report, at least early on in their transition, is a source of anxiety. Some men with strictures will spray urine when they pee or have trouble directing their stream, and it's a source of anxiety, not knowing whether you're going to make a huge mess at a urinal when you've got men standing next to you. Some people who can't stand to pee have dysphoria from that and have to live with that. There's also, I think, another thing that I've sort of put my finger on more recently with patients I've cared for is I think that patients have to balance their desire to have a full size or big penis when they finally can. They have to balance that with having to think a few steps ahead that if the penis is too big, they're not ever going to be able to put it into a partner. And there are other problems. I've commented on, you know, if the penis is too big and long, some penile prosthetics aren't compatible with the penises of that size. So, you know, and unfortunately, the stage in their transition when men get their penis is at the very beginning. So I think it's incumbent on surgeons to be thoughtful and really walk patients through the pitfalls that they very well are not anticipating. I never decide for patients. I make it clear my job is to provide you with information for you to make the choice. But we have to provide patients with that and not succumb to, you know, give me the biggest penis you've seen, because at the end of the day, it doesn't serve them, and then they need surgeries to make it smaller and thinner and so forth. I did with a very good medical student here at UCSF, Dylan Isaacs, and we did a nice study. I had four patients who had very big penises made elsewhere, and none of them, they all complained they couldn't get them into their partners. So they required, at least one, very often two, revision surgeries to thin out the penis. We did a nice study. This is the diameter of the average erect natal male penis. It's 12.3 centimeters with a standard deviation of 1.3 centimeters. Here is the my hypothesis was that, so the question was, the experimental question was, what's the biggest girth that's compatible with intercourse with a vagina? So the hypothesis was that in an open market of dildos, sexual devices, the biggest ones should reflect kind of the biggest that people ever want to use, because bigger than that doesn't fit into the woman or man. So we took the three highest selling dildos of the leading manufacturers and found that the diameter of these was 15.1 centimeters, and that's this yellow circle. And into it, I've put the average erect one. So you see that, you know, on average, you know, the biggest diameter is bigger than the average erect male, but not a ton. And then this is the orange circle is the average diameter of my four patients. And then this is the largest of my four patients. You see the size discrepancy and how this is much bigger than the yellow, which is the biggest dildo diameter. And then down here we see a nice distribution, sort of a normalized curve. And you see that my patients with these big penises are like at the 99.9% percentile. They're just off the charts. They're not going to find, you know, it's no wonder that they have difficulty having intercourse. So I have a few more minutes left. I'm going to wrap up with a quick overview of some evidence-based research and education we're doing here at UCSF. Again, I think evidence-based research and education are the lifeblood of this field. Medical student teaching and curriculum, do together with my colleagues in the Department of Anatomy, cadaver-based surgical training labs, teaching events at local and public sites and universities. I do basic research, histologic studies to validate why some surgical techniques may be better than others. I focus on developing surgical devices. I think others need to be doing this as well. Devices for these surgeries, for these people. Again, it's different anatomy. So we have to not just make do with what we use for natal men, but make devices that are optimized in their design for the transgender surgeries that we perform. I make educational apps, free apps that are available online for trans patients. And then I think it's very important I'm keeping a transgender surgery outcomes database and registry. There's an app out there called Kegel Nation, produced by myself and Peter Carroll here at our department chair. It's free. It's on the Apple iTunes store. I have one specifically for transgender patients coming out soon. It's got a lot of educational content, but it basically it's a biofeedback app that helps people just simply do better Kegel exercises and track their progress. I mentioned that I'd give a brief overview of insurance. This is covered by my colleague, Dr. Dan Karasik, in the first of this lecture series. I'll just briefly say that today in California and in an increasing number of states, there are provisions that simply outlaw the denial of transgender surgery to transgender people. And the definition of is as if it's deemed medically necessary, it can't be denied. So what defines medically necessary? I think it's a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And then evidence that the patient meets the guideline criteria that that insurance company or that provider adhere to, ideally both. So I have my own criteria, and those are the WPATH criteria, our guidelines. And as I said earlier, too, most insurance companies default to those guidelines when they make a checklist of things that patients need to do before they get their surgery. So it's medically necessary. It helps people. And in California and many other states, people can't be discriminated on just because they need it. They're entitled to it. Medi-Cal covers it. Medicare covers it. Soon, apparently, the VA is going to cover it. There's talk about that. It's not official yet, but I think we're moving in that direction. I think we're moving in the direction of equality. So in healthcare, we'll see. Yeah, especially with our new administration, we'll see what happens. But that's the trend. So all of this means that there's a sudden need for gender-affirming surgery and expertise. The role of the urologist, I think the urologist, in the reality, the majority of the long-term complications are urologic complications. Sexual function, that is the need for prosthetics, that is a urologic domain. Urologists normally place those in men. Urinary infections, strictures, urinary tract issues, urologic domains. And then routine urology. Transgender people get stones and get blood in their urine and need to have their bladders looked at. So all of these are things, reasons why urologists need to be involved in this, because these are our core areas of expertise. So I think urologists need to have a basic understanding of, you know, the surgical and post-surgical anatomy. I think we should be familiar with the multidisciplinary care model. Even if the urologist doesn't offer any of these surgeries, we need to kind of know what's what and how to direct patients so they get the good care that I know as physicians we all want to provide. So in conclusion, I think there's a large need and a large benefit from transgender surgical care today. There's benefit and there's need to provide more of it. There's a lot of people out there that need care. This is a fascinating field. I think it needs to be developed like all of the other fields of medicine and surgery, based on evidence-based data and guidelines and outcomes, peer review. We need scientific literature written about the things we do to figure out what's best, what works, and what doesn't work. This is a vulnerable and very grateful patient population that historically has been marginalized, both by society and in healthcare. Things are fortunately changing, but we need to just continue that. I think gender-affirming surgery unifies key urologic domains, that's sexual medicine, andrology and reconstruction, neurourology. So urologists need to be involved in this. We need to lead or help lead in this field. I don't think this surgery belongs to any one specialty. There are fantastic plastic surgeons that do this. But at the end of the day, you want people that have expertise. Wherever they get it, they need to be in this field. So we can all do this, but we need to focus on quality, not anything else. But certainly, you know, these surgeries draw from traditional areas of expertise in urology, so I think urologists need to be involved. And again, as I keep saying, I think this field needs to be advanced in the way all other fields in medicine and surgery are advanced, by peer review, outcomes review, quality metrics, and publishing research. So with that, I want to say thank you very much, and I would love to answer any questions that you might have.
It's kind of off, but I wonder,
yes,
if when there is male to female, have you ever had anyone say, you know what, I actually want to go back to being male?
Everyone invariably asks that. It's a good question. And the fact is that it's exceedingly rare for that to happen.
And what about the surgical process?
For reversal?
Yeah.
Well, it can be done. I mean, when we remove structures from the body, we can't put them back. We can create something of a semblance of what the natal anatomy was, but there is surgery to try to reverse things. But it's very uncommon. And the answer to that is, the reason why is because as long as we adhere to good, make sure that patients are really ready for surgery, we select for the patients that are ready and exclude those that aren't ready. So that's why these waiting periods of a year of social transition of hormones, so that it becomes a natural next step, not something that people choose sort of rashly or, you know, in some sort of mental health instable state. Any other questions? I want to repeat my last comments, the audience member's question, and that is, what about people who, is it common for people to want to reverse, go back after, you know, surgically after gender transition, sort of undo the genital surgery they've had? And that was the question. As I said, it's exceedingly uncommon. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I'd be happy to take any other questions offline after the lecture. Good night. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.